Grove, taking pose yourself photos, and Stella Rondo broke us up. Told him I was one-sided, bigger on one side than the other, which is the deliberate, calculated falsehood. I'm the same. Stella Rondo is exactly 12 months to the day younger than I am, and for that reason, she's spoiled. And it just gets weirder and funnier from there. And it ends with the narrator explaining why she moved out of the family home and started living at the local post office. Much of the effect of the story comes from the way it mimics the cadences of someone who was telling you a story in person. Much of it is in the present tense, with dialogue in the manner of, so I says to her, and then, so she says to me, and so on. Because of the narrator's self-evident self-pity and her unconscious comic exaggeration, it's clear by the end of the story that her version of events is extremely biased, if not flat-out untrue. Unlike Rheticus, however, who admits at the end of his story that he has lied to the reader, Welty's narrator sticks to her guns right to the end. And if Stella Rondo should come to me this minute on bended knees and attempt to explain the incidents of her life with Mr. Whittaker, I'd simply put my fingers in both my ears and refuse to listen. Once again, as with Mark Twain and Huck Finn, we have a narration with a double consciousness. On the one hand, there's the narrator pleading her case with the reader unconvincingly, and on the other, there's Eudora Welty winking at us over her narrator's shoulder. Yet another version of the unreliable narrator is the narrator who may or may not be unreliable, but whose truthfulness is never finally revealed to the reader. One of the most interesting recent examples is the Pakistani writer Mohsin Hamid's The Reluctant Fundamentalist. This novel is told in the first person by a Pakistani man who attended Princeton and who worked on Wall Street, but who, after the events of 9/11, has found himself in reluctant sympathy with the goals of the terrorists. The novel is framed as a long monologue delivered in a cafe in the city of Lahore, as the unnamed narrator tells his life story to an American listener who never speaks. There are increasing hints throughout the book that the narrator may possibly be a terrorist himself. There are also hints that his listener may possibly be an American intelligence agent sent to kill him. The potential unreliability of the narrator is essential to the final impact of this very unsettling and thought-provoking book, and it could only have been done in the first person. In the next lecture, we'll look at a variety of things you can do with the third-person voice, and we'll be talking about how it's used in George Eliot's Middlemarch, George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, and George Pelecanos' detective's novel, The Cut. In the meantime, you might want to experiment with the first-person voice by attempting either the double consciousness that Twain uses in Huckleberry Finn or the unreliable narrator technique used by Eudora Welty or Mohsin Hamid. In the first instance, pick a character whose worldview you disagree with and write in their voice while trying to let your own worldview peek through. In the second instance, write from the point of view of a character who is clearly lying about something. Try to stay faithful to the character's voice while also letting the reader know that what the narrator is saying is not necessarily true. Writing in the first person can be a tricky thing to pull off, but when it's done well, and the reader finds herself caught up in the story as well as the voice, it can be one of the most satisfying experiences a writer and reader can share.
Lecture 17. He, She, It. Third Person Point of View.
It's not like I've done a survey or anything, but I think it's safe to say that some version of the third person is the default narrative voice of most contemporary fiction. With the rise of the memoir in recent years, the first person has given the third person a run for its money. But on the whole, most writers probably feel most comfortable writing in the third person. Why should this be, I wonder? As I said at the beginning of the previous lecture, a first-person narration can seem more natural, and it can certainly be appealing, intimate, and immediate, providing the illusion that we are hearing the events of the story from one of its participants, or at least from a witness. But as I also pointed out, first-person narrators can be deluded, or they can be liars. There is also another drawback, which is common to nearly all first-person narrators, whether they're telling the truth or not. A first-person narrator can usually talk only about the events that he or she has witnessed or has heard about from another source. In addition, the first-person narration can be tricky for a writer because of that double consciousness that I explained in the last lecture. You have a slightly more complicated job when you're writing in the first person. You are not only telling the story, you are also creating an important character at the same time and telling the story through that character's voice. The third person, on the other hand, has a good deal more range and flexibility than the first person. A third-person narration can encompass all sorts of things that a first-person narrator wouldn't know or be able to express. The third person can also, paradoxically, go deeper into an individual character's consciousness than the first person can. If you adopt the godlike perspective of the omniscient third person, for example, every facet of a character's personality and history is made available to the reader. But perhaps most importantly, the third person is probably a more instinctive and natural way to tell a fictional story, especially if you're telling a story about someone who isn't yourself, as most fiction writers are. Most of us tell jokes in the third person. Nearly all fairy tales and folk tales are told in the third person. No one says, "Once upon a time, I went into the woods to my grandmother's house." And many of the great early texts of Western literature are told in the third person, from the Iliad and the Odyssey to Beowulf and Don Quixote. In its most straightforward form, the third person adopts the easy cadence and authority of the traditional oral storyteller. But of course, there are different varieties and flavors of the third person. Think back to my metaphor of the sky from my first lecture about point of view. I started at the zenith with the most omniscient variety of the third person and worked my way down the curve of the sky to the interior version of the first person on the ground level. In this lecture, we're going to look at the varieties of the third person in more detail. I will start with the type of third person narration that is most like the first person and work my way back up to the godlike third person of the great 19th century novelists. What we'll find by the end, spoiler alert, is that most writers usually adopt more than one variety of the third person in the same story or novel. This is different from the way writers tend to use the first person, where you are often locked into one version of the narration throughout the entire story. So, let's start with the close third person, or what is sometimes called free indirect discourse. At the start of this lecture, I said that the third person is the default mode of most contemporary fiction, and the close third person is the type that is most commonly used. In the close third person, you adopt the point of view of only one character at a time, while continuing to use the third-person pronouns he or she. It's very similar to the first person on the whole, because the close third person sticks to what the character knows. It shows us only what that character has seen or heard about, and it shows us only that character's thoughts and feelings. In fact, the close third person traffics in that same double consciousness that the first person does, only with more weight being given to the exterior point of view of the author. In some instances, this kind of third person is so close to the character that it ends up being a de facto first person. In fact, in some uses of the close third person, you could probably switch the narrative into the first person without having to change too much apart from the pronouns. But that's rare. In most cases, the close third person at least contains the possibility of going deeper into the character's head than a simple first-person narration does. This is because the third person allows you to reveal things about the character's thoughts, feelings, intentions, and prejudices that the character himself may not know or understand. A close third person can also reveal the character's secrets. In this respect, the close third person can be more comprehensive than the first person. It allows you to show everything about a character, and not just what the character chooses to reveal. As with any other choice in creative writing, choosing to use this particular point of view means you gain some things and you lose some things. In the first person, you can create a unique voice for the character, the way Twain does for Huck Finn. By choosing to tell the story in the close third person, you lose that distinctive voice. On the other hand, in the close third person, you can dive as deeply into your character's head as Virginia Woolf does in Mrs. Dalloway. Let's take a look at the difference. That moment in Huckleberry Finn where Huck decides to help Jim win his freedom would not be nearly as thrilling in the close third person. The power of that scene comes from watching Huck work it out for himself. If you were to change that passage into the third person, you'd have to pepper it with a lot of phrases like, Huck thought that, or it seemed to Huck that. And right there, you lose the immediacy of it. You lose the feeling that you're watching Huck Finn himself wrestling with his own conscience. At last, Huck decided, all right then, he'd go to hell, is not nearly as powerful a sentence as Huck himself saying, all right then, I'll go to hell. Now think back to that moment in Mrs. Dalloway that I mentioned in an earlier lecture, when Clarissa Dalloway is looking at a shop window. In just a few words, her mind skips with lightning speed from a memory of her father buying suits, to a shop where you could buy perfect gloves, to her uncle saying that you could know a lady by her gloves, to the death of her uncle during the war, to her own passion for gloves, and finally to her remote relationship with her daughter. It's possible to imagine recasting that scene in the first person, but think how clumsy it would be. As I stared in the window of a shop where you used to be able to buy almost perfect gloves, I was reminded of my Uncle William saying that you could know a lady by her shoes and gloves, which reminded me of how he turned over in his bed one morning and died, and so on. Not only is this horribly awkward, it actually changes Mrs. Dalloway as a character. It makes her a much more introspective and self-aware woman than she is in Wolfe's version. It presumes that she understands her own thoughts as well as her author does. Instead, by using a very close, very intimate third person in that scene, we're getting an unself-conscious view of Clarissa Dalloway. We're seeing her intimately, but remotely at the same time. We understand her even better than she could understand herself. Let me put it this way. The close third person is like eavesdropping. We're more likely to believe what a politician says when he doesn't know the microphone is on than when he's wearing his public face and repeating his talking points. The close third person is like an open mic. It lays bare the private Mrs. Dalloway, not just the version of herself that she wants the world to see. Another reason the close third person is more flexible and comprehensive than the first person is that it's easier to shift point of view from one character to another. It's certainly possible to switch from one first-person narrator to another within the same story or book. William Faulkner does it brilliantly in As I Lay Dying, which is narrated by 15 different characters. It's a remarkable achievement, but before you rush off to imitate it, consider this. When you're writing in the first person, you're not only telling the story, you're creating an individual voice for that character. In Faulkner's case, that's 15 different narrators. And even though they all come from the same family, or at least from the same community, they all have to sound at least a little bit different from each other. It's a lot of work, both for the writer and the reader, which is perhaps why this technique isn't used very often. On the other hand, in the close third person, you can switch from one character to another with relative ease, because you don't have to reinvent the voice of the narration itself each time you switch point of view. You can use the same authorial voice to evoke different characters. Mrs. Dalloway is a bravura example of this, of course, often switching point of view within a scene. However, in most instances, writers shift point of view from chapter to chapter. This technique broadens the scope of the story beyond what only one character can know. I learned this the hard way when I was writing my first published novel, The Wild Colonial Boy. That novel was a thriller about a young Irish-American named Brian, who agrees to carry some explosives into Britain for an Irish terrorist. My first three drafts were in the close third person from Brian's point of view. The problem was that in each successive draft, the plot became more complicated. It reached a point where many of the most dramatic moments, a gunfight, a brutal interrogation, a terrorist bombing, happened when Brian wasn't present. This was supposed to be a thriller, and yet the most thrilling scenes entered the novel only as second-hand accounts or news reports. Finally, a friendly agent who agreed to read the third draft suggested that I tell the novel from the alternating points of view of Brian and several other characters in the novel. That way I could show the reader each dramatic moment from the point of view of one of the characters who was actually present, instead of just feebly telling the reader about them later on from Brian's second-hand perspective. This suggestion opened up the book, gave it a much wider scope, and made it much more thrilling. It also forced me to get inside the heads of three more characters, two of whom were women, which was something I might never have attempted on my own. And so I learned that alternating points of view in the close third person is a really powerful way to tell a long story or a novel. It gives you the best of both worlds. Each individual chapter allows you to inhabit the mind of a single character, but by changing the point of view with each subsequent chapter, you can broaden the scope of your narrative. In fact, by using several different point of view characters, you can show different perspectives on the same event. And at the most mechanical level, you can make sure the reader is present at all the most important scenes. Switching between several point of view characters with the close third person is an especially useful technique for very long, epic narratives. It can balance intimacy with a sort of widescreen cinematic expansiveness. George R. R. Martin uses this technique very effectively in his Song of Ice and Fire novels. Each book is told from the points of view of many different characters, and the point of view switches with each chapter. Not only does this allow the reader to see the complex events of the story from multiple points of view, it allows Martin to evoke a vast imaginary world in vivid and evocative detail. And by showing different and often competing perspectives on the same series of events, the series reads less like a simplistic fable of good versus evil, and more like a gritty contemporary account of conflicting interests. Martin also does something else that many writers do when using the close third person. He includes the point of view character's thoughts in the first person, but within the third person narration. Usually these thoughts are set off from the rest of the narration by italics. Here's the character Jaime Lannister, as he's being ferried down a river in a rowboat as a captive in chains, and he's trying to catch a little sleep on the fly. He must have drifted off. The wine had made him sleepy, and it felt good to stretch, a luxury his chains had not permitted him in his cell. Jaime had long ago learned to snatch sleep in the saddle during a march. This was no harder. Then, in italics, Tyrion is going to laugh himself sick when he hears how I slept through my own escape. Then, back to Roman type, he was awake now, though, and the fetters were irksome. When it's done seamlessly, as it is here, this can add yet another dimension to the close third person. And some writers, such as Leo Tolstoy in Anna Karenina, set their characters' thoughts in quotation marks rather than italics, using "she thought" or "she said to herself," rather than the usual dialogue tag, "she said." Other writers incorporate the first-person thoughts of a character without using italics or quotation marks. The entirety of my novel, Next, is told from the close third-person point of view of a single character named Kevin. Before publication, I had a friendly disagreement with the copy editor, who wanted to put Kevin's first-person thoughts in italics. Because the whole book was essentially in Kevin's head, I was afraid that all those italics would simply be distracting, so I insisted on leaving his thoughts in Roman type. Now let's take a quick look at another variety of the third person, namely the objective or remote third person. This is the sort of third person narration that simply describes what the characters do and say without giving the reader access to their thoughts. At first glance, this kind of narration might seem the same as a recording I first person I talked about in the last lecture, in which a character who is tangential to the main story tells the events of the narrative the way Ishmael and Nick Carraway do. But there's a crucial difference. With the recording I first person, the events are still being filtered through a fictional consciousness. And this fictional consciousness often passes judgment or makes educated guesses as to what the other characters are thinking. Nick Carraway may not be central to The Great Gatsby, but he does narrate the story of Gatsby and Daisy from a particular point of view. Nick's take on the events of the novel still colors the reader's understanding. Compare this with the remote third-person narration in Dashiell Hammett's The Maltese Falcon. This narrative perspective watches everything the characters do like a camera, but without giving us direct access to their thoughts and feelings. Here's a moment when Sam Spade is embracing his partner's wife. He's been carrying on an affair with her, and this excerpt comes from the moment when they have found out that his partner and her husband is dead. He grimaced again and bent his head for a surreptitious look at the watch on his wrist. His left arm was around her, the hand on her left shoulder. His cuff was pulled back far enough to leave the watch uncovered. It showed 10:10. The woman stirred in his arms and raised her face again. Her blue eyes were wet, round, and white-ringed. Her mouth was moist. "Oh, Sam," she moaned. "Did you kill him?" Spade stared at her with bulging eyes. His bony jaw fell down. He took his arms from her and stepped back out of her arms. He scowled at her and cleared his throat. Now, it's pretty clear from this that Spade may be a heartless cad, but he's probably not a murderer. And since we don't know what he's actually thinking, we can't be absolutely certain. This kind of third person keeps us at arm's length from its characters. This builds suspense and keeps the reader on his toes, but at the cost of a certain coldness. The opposite of this remote and noncommittal third person is what you might call the engaged or judgmental third person. Even though this variety of the third person is not tied to a character in the story, the voice still has a strong opinion about the events it is relating. You find this type of third person much more commonly in the novels of the 18th and 19th centuries, when authors had no problem passing judgment on the follies of their characters. There is no pretense of objectivity in the narrative voice, which passes judgment right and left without filtering it through a character. This kind of voice works especially well with comic or picaresque novels, like those of the 18th century English writer Henry Fielding. His big comic novel, Tom Jones, regularly passes judgment on the follies of its characters. A generation later, you still hear something of the same voice in Jane Austen, who was a much more subtle writer than Henry Fielding, but also a very sharp judge of flawed characters. Much of Pride and Prejudice is told in the close third person from Elizabeth Bennet's point of view, but there are also memorable passages in which the author herself passes a direct and unmediated judgment. Here's a paragraph from the first chapter, which sums up the badly mismatched marriage of Elizabeth's parents, even before we have met any of their daughters. "Mr. Bennet was so odd a mixture of quick parts, sarcastic humor, reserve, and caprice, that the experience of 23 years had been insufficient to make his wife understand his character. Her mind was less difficult to develop. She was a woman of mean understanding, little information, and uncertain temper. When she was discontented, she fancied herself nervous. The business of her life was to get her daughters married. Its solace was visiting and news." If this is a bit too 19th century for you, let me translate. Mr. Bennet is a quick-witted, intelligent man who keeps his opinions to himself and hides behind his sarcasm. Mrs. Bennet is uneducated and not very intelligent, and she loves gossip and is terrified that her daughters will not marry well. Jane Austen is telling us rather bluntly that this is not a match made in heaven. Perhaps the most enthusiastically judgmental narrator of all time is Charles Dickens. His third-person narration often has great fun at the expense of his characters, and it also doesn't shy away from stern moral outrage. In the opening pages of one of his greatest novels, Bleak House, Dickens is already passing judgment before he has introduced any characters at all, when he describes at length the baleful effect of a complicated chancery court lawsuit. "Jarndyce and Jarndyce drones on. This scarecrow of a suit has, in the course of time, become so complicated that no man alive knows what it means. The parties to it understand at least. But it has been observed that no two chancery lawyers can talk about it for 5 minutes without coming to a total disagreement as to all the premises. Innumerable children have been born into the cause. Innumerable young people have married into it. Innumerable old people have died out of it. Scores of persons have deliriously found themselves made parties in Jarndyce and Jarndyce without knowing how or why. Whole families have inherited legendary hatreds with the suit. and so on. Dickens being Dickens, this goes on for several pages. Modern writers are no less opinionated than Dickens, of course, but they usually don't tell the reader what to think. Instead, most contemporary novelists prefer to stand back and let the events of the novel and the actions of the characters speak for themselves, often while discreetly stacking the deck. Still, there are some modern novelists, such as John Irving and Tom Wolfe, who sometimes use their third-person narrative voice to pass an overt judgment. Let's move now up to the zenith of my imaginary dome, to the omniscient third person. This is the magisterial point of view of the great 19th-century novelists such as George Eliot and Leo Tolstoy. This version of the third person is often described as godlike, but not just because it allows the writer complete access to the world she has created and the inner lives of her characters. Every writer already has that power, of course, no matter what point of view she's using. The omniscient third person is called godlike, rather, because it presents the reader the full range of perspectives, from the most all-encompassing view of a community to the most intimate exchange between two individuals to a character's most private thoughts. The hallmark of this kind of third-person narration, especially in the hands of a great writer like George Eliot, is that it can swoop in a single chapter, and sometimes in a single passage, from the widest view of the story to the most intimate. A good example of this kind of narrative dexterity is Chapter 11 of Eliot's Middlemarch. This is a huge Victorian novel with a lot of characters and a lot of story to tell, and it's set in a small fictional English community called Middlemarch in the 1830s. The whole of Chapter 11 is about 3,500 words, and in the first 1,300 words, Eliot directly tells us about a doctor named Lydgate. Dr. Lydgate is new to the town, and he is interested in marrying a very pretty young woman named Rosamund Vincey. Over the course of the passage, Eliot tells us bluntly that Lydgate is young, poor, and ambitious. She also tells us that the chief quality he wants in a wife is beauty and charm, which is why he has already ruled out the novel's main character, Dorothea Brooke, because Dorothea is too brainy and serious. Eliot also simply tells us that Rosamund Vincey is likewise interested in Lydgate because he is a handsome and accomplished outsider and because she considers herself too good for the boring young men of Middlemarch. In this long passage of pure exposition, Eliot masterfully fits Lydgate and Rosamund within the social hierarchy of the town, and she also takes time to show how love and marriage can disarrange that social hierarchy. Her perspective in the first section of Chapter 11 is as godlike as possible. It is cool and even-handed and remote, with a few flashes of authorial judgment in the manner of Jane Austen or Henry Fielding. Then, in the second part of the chapter, Eliot deftly narrows her focus from the general to the particular. She focuses on the breakfast table conversation of Rosamund's family on a particular morning. We get to watch Rosamund, her brother Fred, and their mother bantering about Rosamund's marriage prospects, the rules of social class in their community, and Fred's opinion of Lydgate, among other things. It's one of my favorite scenes in all of literature because Eliot does so many things at once and does them so well. At the same time as she vividly evokes each individual character and shows their complicated relationships with each other, she also takes care of an important moment in the plot and gives the reader information that will be important later on. And it's all done in a third person that is halfway between a recording eye and the more judgmental third person Eliot was using in the first half of the chapter. The only variety of the third person she doesn't use is the close third person, allowing us to see the scene strictly from inside the mind of Fred, Rosamund, or their mother. Eliot very effectively places us in the room with these characters. She allows us to witness each twist and turn of their conversation and to watch their body language. But with the reserve of the 19th century novelist, she does not encourage us to see through the eyes of any of the characters in the scene or even to identify with any one of them. Which is not to say that an omniscient third-person narration can't incorporate the close third person as well. In Anna Karenina, which was published only a few years after Middlemarch, Tolstoy writes much of the novel in the same magisterial, omniscient third person that Eliot uses, and he keeps us at a slight remove from the characters. But at certain points in the novel, especially with Anna herself and with another character named Levin, he also delves into a close third person that seems very contemporary to a modern reader. In the famous climax of the book, when Anna rushes about Moscow in a panic before her fateful encounter with a locomotive, the novel delves deep into her mind, mixing her first-person thoughts with an extremely intimate close third person. The omniscient third person of the rest of the novel keeps us at arm's length from these Russian aristocrats, but in this passage, the distance between the reader and the character is almost completely erased. Anna's pain and desperation are visceral, and whether you approve of her choices or not, you can't read about her fate without a racing pulse. Modern writers, of course, have all of these techniques at their disposal. While it may be true that the close third person remains the default mode for many writers, you'll also find that most writers feel free to mix and match the varieties of the third person in surprising and innovative ways. The contemporary American crime novelist George Pelecanos stands in direct line of descent from Dashiell Hammett and Elmore Leonard. And like Hammett and Leonard, much of his narration is of the recording eye variety. In very spare language, Pelecanos gives us detailed descriptions of what his characters look like, what they wear, and what they say and do. His novel, The Cut, for example, is told mostly from the point of view of a young private investigator in Washington, D.C., named Spiro Lucas. Much of the story follows Spiro closely as he gets involved in a complicated case involving drug dealers. But occasionally, the narration varies from the remote third person into the close third person. In this passage, for example, Spiro, in the manner of all warm-blooded private detectives, is leaving the home of a woman named Lisa Weitzman, with whom he has just had a one-night stand. His father had once told him, "Don't let anything walk past you," and Lucas knew well what that meant. There are opportunities that are there for only a short period of time and only available to people of a certain age. He and Lisa Weitzman understood. They'd had fun. He didn't want to be one of those sad middle-aged guys who think about the women they should have bedded in their youth if only they'd been less sensible. He planned to age with good memories. This is one of the rare moments in the book when we get direct access to Spiro's thoughts and feelings, but in the context of a detective thriller, it's enough. What's even more interesting, however, is that Pelecanos himself very occasionally steps in to pass judgment on his character in the 19th century manner. Here's Spiro not long after his one-night stand, delivering a bunch of roses to Lisa's door. He went up the steps of Lisa Weitzman's home and laid the roses, heavily wetted, on her doorstep, along with a note he had written in a childish scrawl before getting out of his vehicle. The note was corny and obvious, something about how nice it was to hang out with her. He had no plans to try and see her again, but he wanted to do something respectful for her, at least. Flowers had come to mind. He was a resourceful, but not particularly original young man. Much of the judgment in this paragraph is implicit, the childish scrawl of the note, its corny and obvious wording, but there's a stinger in the tail of the paragraph. Like George Eliot passing bemused judgment on Dr. Lydgate's distaste for brainy women, Pelecanos himself briefly steps in to let us know that Spiro still has some growing up to do. Little moments like this help to make it clear that the author doesn't necessarily endorse everything his protagonist does. You can do this in the first person only by implication, but in the third person, you can come right out and say what you think. In the next lecture, I'll be talking about the various ways setting can be used in fiction, and we'll be looking at some famous bits of scene setting from Dickens' Bleak House and The Lord of the Rings, as well as some different uses of setting from Mr. Pelecanos and the British writer Rosemary Sutcliffe. In the meantime, here's an exercise that explores some of the power and flexibility of the third person. Pick a stressful or contentious situation between two characters, such as an argument between a husband and wife, or an interrogation scene where a cop is trying to get a confession out of a suspect. Then, tell the scene three different ways, each in the third person. Once in the close third person, from the point of view of one character, the cop, for example. And then tell the same situation again in the close third person from the point of view of the suspect. Then, in the third paragraph, try to go all George Eliot and look on the scene from the omniscient third person, showing the same situation again from a godlike perspective.
Lecture 18. Evoking Setting and Place in Fiction.
Every story has a setting, but setting is not equally important to all stories. For some narratives, setting is just a painted theatrical backdrop against which the story plays out. And that backdrop can be changed for another one without fundamentally changing the story itself. Think of those modern dress Shakespeare productions where Richard III is played as a fascist from the 1930s, or Macbeth is played as an ambitious investment banker, or the Montagues and the Capulets in Romeo and Juliet are portrayed as rival street gangs in Miami. And it's not just Shakespeare. One of the best films ever made from a Jane Austen novel is the 1990s teen comedy Clueless. This film very successfully and surprisingly faithfully sets Austen's novel Emma in a contemporary Los Angeles high school. Here's another example. Christina Stead's brilliant novel about a dysfunctional family, The Man Who Loved Children, was originally set in Stead's native Australia. But in order to make it more appealing to American readers, she was persuaded by her publisher to move the setting to Washington, D.C. In most contemporary fiction, however, setting is important. Much of what can make a novel or story memorable is the author's careful evocation of a particular place and time. To pick two obvious examples, Raymond Chandler's Philip Marlowe novels are inextricably linked with Los Angeles in the middle part of the 20th century. And Flannery O'Connor's stories will be forever associated with the rural American South. An evocative and memorable setting doesn't even have to be real. Much of the appeal of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings comes from the way its characters and the reader move through the lovingly detailed landscape of Middle-earth. Tolkien's settings are so detailed and evocative that if you've read Lord of the Rings more than once, as I have, chances are you could be dropped anywhere in Middle-earth and find your way around. Setting can also mean a particular time period as well. The British novelist Hilary Mantel is famous for her attention to historical accuracy in her novels set in the court of Henry VIII, Wolf Hall, and Bring Up the Bodies. And the thrillers of Alan First owe much of their excitement to his detailed evocation of Europe during the rise of the Nazis. Another writer who is known for her evocative settings is Rosemary Sutcliffe, who is best known for her series of young adult novels about Roman Britain, The Eagle of the Ninth, The Silver Branch, and The Lantern Bearers. Each of these books skillfully evokes both the time period and the landscape of ancient Britain and Scotland. Sutcliffe had a keen appreciation of the natural world and a sharp eye for the telling detail. Of course, all fictional narratives are set somewhere, whether the particular setting is essential or not. At the very least, setting establishes a context for the characters and the plot, since not even fictional characters come out of nowhere. Sometimes it's just a backdrop. Two households, both alike in dignity, in fair Verona, where we lay our scene. But more often than not, setting does more in the narrative than just situating us in time and place. In this lecture, I want to talk first about some of the purposes to which setting can be put in a narrative. After that, I'll talk about how you can evoke setting in a story, which depends on the purpose of the setting. Let's start by looking at some of the ways that you can use setting in a story or a novel. In many narratives, setting can be a metaphor for the narrative as a whole. One of the most famous examples is the opening paragraph of Bleak House, Charles Dickens' great novel about a complicated and never-ending lawsuit in mid-19th century England. Here are the opening words. London, Michaelmas term lately over, and the Lord Chancellor is sitting in Lincoln's Inn Hall. Implacable November weather. As much mud in the streets as if the waters had but newly retired from the face of the earth, and it would not be wonderful to meet a megalosaurus, 40 feet long or so, waddling like an elephantine lizard up Holborn Hill. Smoke lowering down from chimney pots, making a soft black drizzle with flakes of soot in it as big as full-grown snowflakes, gone into mourning, one might imagine, for the death of the sun. Dogs, undistinguishable in mire. Horses, scarcely better, splashed to their very blinkers. Foot passengers, jostling one another's umbrellas in a general infection of ill temper and losing their foothold at street corners, where tens of thousands of other foot passengers have been slipping and sliding since the day broke, if this day ever broke, adding new deposits to the crust upon crust of mud, sticking at those points tenaciously to the pavement and accumulating at compound interest. The next paragraph is an equally detailed and equally unsettling account of the London fog. Dickens describes how it creeps everywhere and obscures everything, how it gets into the eyes and throats of ancient pensioners by their firesides and pinches the toes and fingers of a ship's apprentice boy. And so before we ever meet a character, and before the plot even starts, Dickens has indelibly evoked a vision of dark, dirty London full of filthy animals, ill-tempered pedestrians, and poor people wheezing and shivering in the all-encompassing fog. This exceptionally vivid setting sets up two purposes. On the one hand, it vividly evokes the sensory details of London in the mind of the reader, the darkness, the cold, the dirt. On the other hand, the setting serves as a metaphor for the misty, insinuating, impenetrably foggy coils of the lawsuit itself. Here's another example. J.G. Farrell's historical novel Troubles is about the Irish rebellion against British rule in the years after World War I. The main setting is a giant resort hotel on the Irish coast called the Majestic. This Baroque old building serves all the way through the novel as a metaphor for the grand, ornate, crumbling edifice of the British Empire. At the end of the novel, the Irish Republican Army burns the hotel to the ground. The actual destruction of the hotel represents the metaphorical destruction of the dominance of Protestants and the British in Ireland. On the last page, the novel's main character, a gentle and befuddled retired British Army major, surveys the ruins, which includes the skeletons of the hundreds of cats that lived in the hotel. There is very little to see except that great collection of wash basins and lavatory bowls which had crashed from one burning floor to another until they reached the ground. He inspected the drips of molten glass which had collected like candle grease beneath the windows. He noted the large number of delicate little skeletons. The charred and roasted demons had been picked clean by the rats. He stepped from one blackened compartment to another, trying to orientate himself and saying, "I'm standing in the residence lounge, in the corridor, in the writing room." Now that these rooms were open to the mild Irish sky, they all seemed much smaller, in fact, quite insignificant. This evocative but brief excerpt can't convey the full effect of this final scene, but take my word for it. The vast, crumbling, mostly empty Majestic is an oppressive presence all the way through the whole book, with its clueless Anglo-Irish owners, its sullen Irish servants, and a surrounding countryside seething with resentment. Even if he or she doesn't know anything about the history of the Irish Revolution, every reader will understand that in that final scene, the major is surveying the ruins of an empire, and not just a burnt-out old hotel. I want to emphasize that each of these two settings, foggy, dirty London in Bleak House and the Majestic Hotel in Troubles, are also full of vivid sensory details that draw you into the scene and into the book. They put you in the moment, even if you aren't consciously picking up on the metaphor. A setting should be visceral and vivid, even when you are using it for a metaphorical purpose. Whatever its symbolic intent, a carefully evoked setting should allow us to experience that imaginary world as if we were characters in the story. You can also use setting to evoke mood, especially when the point of the book is to evoke a strong vicarious emotion. This is especially true in genre fiction such as horror, where you want to evoke fear in a reader. Here's part of a description of a haunted house from the early pages of Judith Hawk's marvelously creepy novel, Julian's House. Inside the gate, so overgrown with honeysuckle that it no longer swings freely but seems to protest against being opened, the yard slopes ever so slightly down to the house, and you may find your pace quickening in spite of yourself as you approach. The broad flagstones leading the way are cracked now and worn with the pressure of feet going back and forth across them. Grass springs up in the cracks, and the once sharp edges are soft with moss. Inside the gate, a silence falls. Leaves stir and are still. At the foot of the porch steps, the silence deepens, wrapped around with the fragrance of the shallow pink roses that twine the uprights and shadow the wide boards with their leaves. And yet it is more than a silence, as the leaves stir and again are still. It is a silence of breath held, of a sob stifled in a pillow, the silence that follows the blow of a fist upon a table. In the moving leaves, this silence seems to murmur in its sleep, of too many closed doors, keys turning smoothly in well-oiled locks, glances exchanged without words. Even if we hadn't already been told that this is a haunted house, it would be hard to read this description and not sense immediately that there is something wrong with this house, that there is something bad waiting inside. There are a lot of nifty little details in this passage, but I'll just point out one. You might not notice it on a first reading, but Hawkes uses the word silence 6 times in the paragraph. Normally, the repetition of a word that many times in so short a passage is anathema to writers, or at least to copy editors. But here the repetition has the effect of making the silence ominous, like a thundercloud building on the horizon. More importantly, the word silence is paired with such active verbs as falls, deepens, and murmur. The use of these verbs changes the silence from the absence of sound to an active presence in the house. This is a very skillful bit of scene setting. You could also use setting to tell us about the characters in a story. A description of a room or a house is often used to tell us something about the person who lives there. One of the major plot lines in George Eliot's Middlemarch is the ill-advised marriage of Dorothea Brooke, an intense young woman in her early 20s, to Edward Casaubon, a dry and humorless scholar who is 30 years her senior. Early in the book, after their surprise engagement, Dorothea goes to visit Mr. Casaubon's home. The building, of greenish stone, was in the old English style, not ugly, but small-windowed and melancholy-looking, the sort of house that must have children, many flowers, open windows, and little vistas of bright things to make it seem a joyous home. In this latter end of autumn, with a sparse remnant of yellow leaves falling slowly athwart the dark evergreens in a stillness without sunshine, the house, too, had an air of autumnal decline, and Mr. Casaubon, when he presented himself, had no bloom that could be thrown into relief by that background. Now, even if the reader hadn't already begun to suspect that Dorothea's marriage to Casaubon was a bad idea, this description should make up his mind. Nearly everything Eliot says about the house, that it's small-windowed and melancholy, that the grounds around it are dark, still, and without sunshine, and that it has an air of autumnal decline, could also be said about Casaubon himself. The last clause of the passage is one of the great backhanded insults in English literature, when Eliot says that there is nothing about Casaubon himself that could be thrown into relief by his joyless home. Setting can also be used to evoke the passage of time and the movement of characters through a landscape. Tolkien is especially skillful at describing the geography of Middle-earth. In part, this is simply because he delights in evoking the natural world. But these passages also literally slow the narrative down, and this has the effect of evoking the slow passage of characters who are moving on foot through a vast and often spectacular landscape. Here are the hobbits Frodo and Sam passing through the land of Ithilien in the Two Towers. Day was opening in the sky, and they saw that the mountains were now much further off, receding eastward in a long curve that was lost in the distance. Before them, as they turned west, gentle slopes ran down into dim hazes far below. All about them were small woods of resinous trees, fir and cedar and cypress, and other kinds unknown in the Shire, with wide glades among them, and everywhere there was a wealth of sweet-smelling herbs and shrubs. The long journey from Rivendell had brought them far south of their own land, but not until now, in this more sheltered region, had the hobbits felt the change of clime. Here spring was already busy about them, fronds pierced moss and mold, Larches were green-fingered. Small flowers were opening in the turf. Birds were singing. Ithilien, the garden of Gondor, now desolate, kept still a disheveled dryad loveliness. This lovely passage evokes both the vastness of the landscape through which Frodo and Sam are moving, as well as their own sense of wonder at it. Notice how the passage effectively shifts our focus from the long distance to the close up. We see the mountains as a long curve that was lost in the distance. But in the next sentence, we get particular types of trees, fir and cedar and cypress. And finally, we get the individual harbingers of spring, fronds piercing moss, green-fingered larches, flowers opening in the turf. And the fact that the reader is required to slow down during this passage and to stop and smell the flowers also evokes the slowness of Frodo and Sam's journey. But setting doesn't have to slow down the narrative. You can also use setting to evoke speed and danger. Here's part of a chase scene from Rosemary Sutcliffe's The Eagle of the Ninth. Her two main characters, the Roman soldier Marcus and his slave Esca, are fleeing on horseback across the Scottish Highlands from a band of Pictish tribesmen. He was riding for his life with the dark hunt in full cry behind him, putting out all his skill to keep clear of hidden pitfalls, the hummocks and snags and snarls among the heather that might bring disaster, grimly aware that he could not grip strongly enough with his right knee, and if the pony stumbled at this flying gallop, he would go clean over its head. On and on they hurtled, now skirting a reed-fringed upland pool, now swerving from a patch of bog luminously green in the fading light, uphill and down, through bronze tides of dying heather, startling here a flock of plover, there a stray curlew from the bents, and always, behind them, the hunt drawing nearer. Marcus could hear the hounds giving tongue above the soft thunder of the pony's hooves, nearer, steadily nearer, but there was no time for looking back. Here, as in Tolkien, we can delight in the vivid evocation of the landscape in its own right, the luminous green bogs, the bronze tides of dying heather. But we should also note how Sutcliffe skillfully interweaves the flashes of landscape description with breathless action. It should be obvious from the examples we've already looked at that there are many different ways to evoke setting in fiction. As always, the various methods for evoking setting fall between two ends of a continuum. At one end, you evoke setting by stopping the narrative dead in its tracks and describing a place or time period in detail. At the other end, you barely evoke setting at all. In general, the method of stopping the narrative in its tracks is used in narratives such as Bleak House or Troubles, where the setting is important to the story. At the other extreme, when the setting isn't that important to the story, you simply don't bother with it. Most novels and short stories fall somewhere in between, combining the various methods. Let's take a look at some examples. We'll start with the two opposite poles and then examine some examples that fall somewhere in between. In narratives that rely upon standalone descriptions of setting, point of view the writer is using determines how she evokes the setting. The omniscient third person is going to be more cinematic, like an objective camera eye. Take the opening of Bleak House that we looked at earlier. It's like a crane shot in a movie, one that starts high up, smoke lowering down from chimney pots, making a soft black drizzle, then slowly descends to street level, dogs undistinguishable in mire. There it becomes a tracking shot, showing us the masses of Londoners struggling through the mud and the fog, but not from any individual person's point of view, foot passengers jostling one another's umbrellas in a general infection of ill temper. And remember, this passage does two things simultaneously. It gives our mind's eye something to look at, and it introduces a central metaphor for the plot. Now, when a standalone set-piece description of setting is told from the limited third-person or the first-person point of view, it also does one more thing. Namely, it evokes character. How the character sees the setting, what details he or she picks out as important, tell us something about the person through whose eyes we, the readers, are seeing them. J.G. Farrell's Troubles is told in the close third person from the point of view of Major Archer, a shell-shocked veteran of World War I. A diffident and sometimes befuddled man, Archer walks through the burnt-out ruins of the Majestic at the end of the book and merely takes note of the melted glass and the skeletons of dead cats. The metaphorical intent of the scene is lost on the major. He does not draw any of the connections between the Majestic Hotel and the British Empire. Instead, it's the author who makes that connection, by using that narrative double consciousness that I talked about in a previous lecture. In the last sentence of the paragraph I quoted earlier, Farrell writes, "Now that these rooms were open to the mild Irish sky, they all seemed much smaller, in fact, quite insignificant." This is an oblique, sly, but sharp comment about the end of Empire, and it doesn't come from Major Archer, but from the author. A setting can become even more multi-layered when it is described from the first-person point of view. A few minutes ago, I said that setting is part of the appeal of the novels of Raymond Chandler because of the way he records the city of Los Angeles during a particular time in its history. But what makes the setting especially distinctive in Chandler is the fact that it is seen through the eyes and mind of Chandler's main character and protagonist, the private detective Philip Marlowe. Here's the second paragraph of Chandler's first novel, The Big Sleep, in which Marlowe is entering the Los Angeles mansion of a rich client named General Sternwood. The main hallway of the Sternwood place was two stories high. Over the entrance doors, which would have let in a troop of Indian elephants, there was a broad stained glass panel showing a knight in dark armor rescuing a lady who was tied to a tree and didn't have any clothes on but some very long and convenient hair. The knight had pushed the visor of his helmet back to be sociable, and he was fiddling with the knots on the ropes that tied the lady to the tree and not getting anywhere. I stood there and thought that if I lived in the house, I would sooner or later have to climb up there and help him. He didn't seem to be really trying. This goes on for another couple of paragraphs, but this is enough to make my point. This paragraph does several things all at once. First, it sets the scene visually so we know where we are. Second, it tells us right from the start that General Sternwood is very rich, an impression that is immediately reinforced by the next two paragraphs and several other passages of description later in the chapter. Third, it tells us a good deal about Marlowe himself. We learn that he is an alert, sharp-eyed, and witty observer of his surroundings. We learn that he quickly takes the measure of his environment and the people he meets. Fourth, the stained glass window with the knight and the naked lady foreshadows the plot. General Sternwood is being blackmailed by a photographer who has taken nude pictures of his youngest daughter. Marlowe is being hired to become, in effect, the knight in dark armor whose job it is to free her from the pornographer's clutches. Let's take a look now at a writer who scarcely evokes setting at all, at least not in the modern sense, Jane Austen. Compared to a modern writer, Austen hardly ever describes anything, either settings or characters. Mr. Darcy is the leading man of Pride and Prejudice, and here is the only physical description he gets in the entire book. Mr. Darcy drew the attention of the room by his fine, tall person, handsome features, noble mien. That's it. That's all we get of him, a description that could fit any number of men. Well, the same goes for Austen's evocations of setting. Her description of Mr. Darcy's mansion, Pemberley, is slightly more extensive than her description of Darcy himself, but not by much. "The eye was instantly caught by Pemberley House, situated on the opposite side of the valley, into which the road with some abruptness wound. It was a large, handsome stone building, standing well on rising ground and backed by a ridge of high woody hills. And in front, a stream of some natural importance was swelled into greater, but without any artificial appearance." That's all there is, and none of it is particularly evocative. Note in particular the abstract adjectives she uses to describe the house itself, as opposed to the landscape in which it sits. All she tells us about the house is that it is large, handsome, and made of stone. Just as Darcy's description could describe half the titled landowners in England, the description of his home could fit nearly every other English country house at the time. And yet, it's not fair to say that Austen was completely uninterested in evoking setting. Jane Austen could rely upon the fact that she and her readers shared a social and geographical context, and so she could use a kind of shorthand. Reading novels was still mostly an elite practice in Austen's day. She knew that her educated readers would recognize the real places she cited in the text, and then be able to interpolate the nature and approximate location of the fictional places. The village of Longbourn, in Pride and Prejudice, for example, is fictional, but it is situated in the real English county of Hertfordshire, and Austen could count on her readers knowing what Hertfordshire looks like. In the same novel, another family, the Gardiners, live on Gracechurch Street, a real street in London, and Austen knew that her readers would know where Gracechurch Street is and what sort of people live there. Put it in modern terms, you might say that Jane Austen was